Item seven, Peter is going to present this.
Yeah, I'm going to introduce Kristen from the Urban and Community Forestry. Kristen Ramstead is the director of the Urban and Community Forestry. And they were planning to do an update on urban and community forestry, which they try to do every year, but we missed it last year. And so relatively at the last minute, I asked her to do it and to bring in climate and human health effects of the urban and community forestry program. And she's lined up two well-qualified speakers, which I will let her introduce. And so there'll be an update on urban and community forestry and then some current research on that. And this is really to help inform the board of how we're thinking of incorporating urban and community forestry into our climate action plan that we're bringing to you in January. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kristen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Well, as Peter said, this presentation will focus on three areas. First, the current work and outreach of the Urban and Community Forestry Assistance Program. Second, the importance of urban forestry on city livability, social equity, and human health. And third, how Oregon's urban and community forestry program can meet increasing urban forestry needs in Oregon's urban communities and also mitigate the effects of climate change. The mission of the Urban and Community Forestry Assistance Program is to help Oregonians improve the quality of their lives by promoting community investment in our urban forests. The program is part of the Private Forests Division and is solely supported by federal funding through the Forest Service. This is why our work is so specific. We are a resource primarily for city staff, tree board volunteers, elected city officials, and urban forestry nonprofits, and we mostly focus on public trees in cities. We are also a go-to resource for many of the tree care questions that ODF gets from the general public. This program relies on collaboration. The other urban forestry program staff, Katie Lampa and I, have worked as a team for over 20 years. Just as important, Oregon Community Trees, the nonprofit organization that serves our state Urban Forestry Council, is a key partner. Oregon Community Trees' assistance and support over many years has been an essential part of the program's success. And I just want to say with this photo, even though it's taken in December of 2018, most of those board members are still on board and enthusiastically and actively supporting the work that we do. It used to be that urban forestry was just about the management of street and park trees. Nowadays, an urban forest includes not just street and park trees, but all of the tree canopy and related vegetation within urban growth boundaries, such as large forest patches and stands, backyard trees, trees along urban streams, and trees in parking lots, etc. Similar to wildland or rural forests, an urban forest is both defined by its location and is comprised of many different owners and interests. The location of urban trees relative to the quality and quantity of soils and water available to them is critical to understanding the health of an urban forest. Trees, soils, water, and how they support each other are also important to the issues of carbon storage, increasing forest canopy in underserved areas, and optimizing environmental benefits. When urban foresters look at a community forest, we see the trees as ambassadors of livability. The work of Dr. Kathy Wolfe at the University of Washington suggests that people spend more in attractively treed downtown shopping areas. People drive more slowly through treed neighborhoods, especially if the streets are also narrower. Healthy trees along streets, parks, and other public right-of-ways, in essence, we think, advertise how a city takes care of its businesses and residents. The subliminal message is, if a city takes good care of its urban trees, it also takes good care of its city residents. Unhealthy and poorly cared for trees send a much different message. No other program promotes urban forestry better than the Arbor Day Foundation's Tree City USA program, which we administer here at the Department for Oregon Cities. Since the start of the urban forestry program in 91, the number of Oregon Tree City USAs has grown from 16 to 67. Tree City USA and its partner Growth Award program help us in two ways. First, the Tree City USA standards help cities build sustainable urban forestry programs. Second, it is one of the most effective outreach strategies we have in our program. So consider this, the Forest Service measures the urban forestry program's success and also determines its funding by outputs we can't control, such as the number of cities that have a tree ordinance or the cities that hire professionally trained urban foresters. We do a great job at offering research-based technical advice, visiting cities on site, offering many training opportunities, but we have few means to incentivize what cities do. So enter the Tree City USA program. Research suggests that effective ways of changing behavior include setting standards, connecting to values, and establishing social norms. One reason that Tree City USA is so effective is because Oregon Tree City USA communities set a tree care standard for other cities. Other cities want to be like them. Not only are trees ambassadors of livability in cities, Oregon's Tree City USAs are ambassadors of urban forestry management. Oh, and another thing that's really cool about the Tree City USA program is that every year, ODF personnel all over the state are invited to participate in local cities' Arbor Day celebrations because all tree cities need to celebrate and proclaim Arbor Day in order to recertify annually. So this allows the community to meet their local ODF people and to see them playing a role in their community that's different from what they usually do. Regrettably, for many communities, public trees represent liability and expense. Also, some cities and neighborhoods simply cannot accommodate trees well with the way their sidewalks and shopping areas are currently designed. Just by observing the health and distribution of trees alone, one can gain a sense of the fiscal realities facing low-income city neighborhoods and rural towns. In most years, the program directly assists 115 to 130 of Oregon's 241 incorporated cities, many cities more than once. So about one third to one half of the cities that we assist annually are not Tree City USAs. So what do I mean by assistance? I mean that the program both reaches out and responds to city requests for many forms of urban forestry guidance. But I have to say that just by adhering to the modest dictum of right tree, right place, can put most cities, no matter where they are, on the path to better management of their urban trees. Nowadays, urban trees contribute to lessening chronic problems in cities like flooding and stormwater management. Previously, only engineered solutions, things like huge underground pipes and pumps, were the primary way to deal with too much water in urban areas. Urban trees help stormwater management by intercepting and absorbing stormwater in their leaves and branches, and also they slow down rainwater as it comes down so that it seeps into the soil, keeping rainwater in place on the soil is extremely important, so it's not just sort of flushed out by urban pipes. Urban trees also lessen the effects of climate change by cooling neighborhoods and urban streams. Shaded pavements last longer. In shaded parking lots, less gasoline is volatilized from parked vehicles on hot days. Well-shaded homes have lower air conditioning bills. Trees can both store carbon and lessen the need for carbon to be released. Urban forest systems and green stormwater management is getting so much focus that the National Association of State Foresters is asking all state urban forestry programs across the U.S. to track their stormwater mitigation outreach to the communities in their state. We here in the department are also tracking the green stormwater infrastructures that cities are using, because we're planning to feature this topic in a future urban forestry conference. To assist cities in managing their community forests, last year the Urban Forestry Program purchased tree inventory and mapping software called Tree Plotter. Tree Plotter is extremely easy to use. A city can create an urban forestry management plan with this software just by recording a few details of their trees, such as species, diameter at breast height, and general condition. And the software also allows for use that's much more sophisticated as well. Several cities and schools are interested in using Tree Plotter specifically because it can help them estimate the eco-benefits of their inventory trees. Tree Plotter references the National Tree Benefits Calculator, a widely used tool in urban forestry, for this information. And I recently heard that the powers that be are actually upgrading and rethinking the algorithm behind this calculator, and Tree Plotter will be incorporating the changes as they come down the pike. Urban forestry is at its heart about how trees in cities can improve the lives of people. In some ways, it's too bad that urban forestry wasn't instead called something like anthroforestry to reflect trees' capacity to improve human urban conditions on many levels. So I have invited two presenters to join me today. First will be Dr. Jeff Donovan, who will speak to the importance of our community trees to human health. Dr. Donovan works as an economist for the USDA Forest Service in Alaska and in Oregon. Then following Dr. Donovan, Dr. Vivek Chandas will show how past practices have created urban forestry patterns and legacies in Portland. Dr. Chandas is a professor of climate adaptation and director of the Sustaining Urban Places Research Lab at Portland State University. Okay, so Dr. Donovan, I'm going to unshare my screen so that you can be ready to share yours.
Right.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, let me share my screen then. Just give me 1 second. And there we go. Well, thank you very much. I've got really a very simple task in the next 15 minutes. I'm just going to try and convince you of one thing. I'm going to try and convince you that urban trees are a matter of life and death. Now, I don't mean this as a figure of speech. I don't mean this as a metaphor. What I mean is that urban trees are improving people's health, improving their health, and literally saving their lives. So to support this somewhat startling assertion, I'm going to share the results from three of my studies. The first was done in Portland and looked at the relationship between urban trees and birth outcomes. The second is a national study that looked at the public health effects of tree loss from the emerald ash borer. And the third is actually a group of studies that I recently completed in New Zealand, looking at how trees and plants may protect children against immune diseases such as asthma and childhood leukemia. So let's begin with my study of trees and birth outcomes in Portland. Well, why would I choose to study birth outcomes? Well, because they matter. If a baby is born underweight or premature, then that significantly increases the risk that a child dies or suffers serious health outcomes. And these problems can be breathtakingly expensive to treat. Neonatal intensive care units are extremely costly places. In addition, children who are born underweight or premature can suffer lifelong problems. For example, they tend to do worse in school and they have lower lifetime earnings, for example. Now, the next question that we need to ask ourselves is, how could trees improve birth outcomes? Now, it turns out there is a range of mechanisms through which trees could plausibly improve outcomes. Two examples are stress and air quality. So we know, for example, several studies have shown that trees can absorb air pollution. And public health research has shown that women who are exposed to higher levels of air pollution are more likely to have adverse birth outcomes. We also know that if we were all to now unplug our computers and go outside and sit under a tree, that our physiological markers of stress would go down. Our blood pressure would go down. Our heart rate would go down. Our salivary cortisol, the stress hormone, that would go down too. And numerous studies have shown that maternal stress is a risk factor for poor birth outcomes. So given these plausible pathways linking trees and birth outcomes, I decided to design a study to determine whether women with more trees around their homes had healthier babies. Now, one difficulty with studies like this, as Vivek is going to recover in more detail in a moment, is that trees are correlated with race, income, and other drivers of public health. So we had to statistically take account of these factors. And only after doing that, we looked at tree cover in 50 meter buffers around the center of each woman's house. So on the left here, you have a high resolution aerial photograph. And I should say, for privacy reasons, these are not women in the study, just random women. And the green rectangles there is the woman's yard. And then the red dot is the center of that yard. On the right, you have what's called classified aerial imagery. And that's really when you just have a picture broken down into 1 meter cells. And those cells are classified as either tree canopy, that's the dark green, or non-canopy, which is the off-white. And then you have those 50 meter pink circles. So what do we find? Well, we found that women with more tree canopy within 50 meters of their homes, within these pink circles, were less likely to have underweight babies. Now, that's certainly an important public health finding, but you know, some of you might quite rightly say, well, this could just be a statistical oddity. But since I published this study, this is the first study to look at birth outcomes and the natural environment. Since I published it, at least a dozen other studies in multiple countries have found that exposure to the natural environment is associated with better birth outcomes. However, all of these studies suffer from what I call the nice tree, nice neighborhood problem. That is, neighborhoods with more trees tend to be whiter, wealthier, and better educated. And we certainly know that race, education, and income are major drivers of public health outcomes. Now, I took exhaustive steps to untangle these relationships, but you can never be absolutely sure that you've captured everything. And I was fretting about this a few years ago, and for probably the first and only time in my life, my anxiety actually paid off. And I realized I could turn this question on its head. That is, if trees are good for you, then killing them should be bad for you. Well, why is that such a grand revelation? Why is looking at the problem backwards so useful? Well, because the statistical consequences of the nice tree, nice neighborhood problem are reduced when you're looking at tree loss over time, rather looking at differences in tree cover at one point in time. So if you can look at longitudinal change, you're just in better shape statistically. But to do that, you'd need a lot of trees to die in a short amount of time. What could do that? Well, unfortunately, invasive pests can often do an admirable job of killing a lot of trees in a short amount of time. And probably the nastiest in the US in the last 20 years has been the emerald ash borer, first discovered in Detroit in 2002. And this picture gives you an idea of what it can do and unfortunately what it will do to the trees in Oregon. This is taken in 2006 in Toledo, a beautiful ash-lined street. And this is the same street 3 years later. So quite devastating. So what health outcomes could be affected by this sort of catastrophic loss of trees? Well, two that could be a cardiovascular disease and low respiratory disease. And these are the first and third biggest killers in the US. Now, as with birth outcomes, mechanisms linking these two diseases with tree loss would include air quality and stress reduction. And so we have limited time, so I'm just going to cut to the bottom line here. What we found is that tree loss from EAB was associated with increased mortality from both cardiovascular disease and lower respiratory disease. And this effect increased in size and significance as an infestation progressed. So more trees died, more people died. And we also saw a bigger impact in wealthier counties. And I think Vivek will have some insight into why that would be in a moment. And the reason really is that if the wealthier counties are going to have more trees, they're going to provide greater health benefits. So when you take them away, you're going to see greater negative impact. And that is indeed what we saw. And across 6 years and 15 states, we saw an additional 15,000 deaths from cardiovascular disease and 6,000 from lower respiratory disease. So 21,000 additional deaths, that's a non-trivial number. This is quite literally life and death stuff. Now, so far, what we've talked about exclusively is the quantity of trees that a person is exposed to. So more trees means better birth outcomes, or fewer trees means more deaths from cardiovascular disease, for example. However, the type of trees and plants that a person is exposed to also matters. Now, some of you may have heard of the hygiene hypothesis. What that posits is that people who are exposed to greater microbial diversity are less prone to immune diseases. And the term was coined in 1989 by David Strachan. And it was based on the observation that children who have more older siblings are less likely to get hay fever. Older siblings expose, if you have more older siblings, you get more exposed to microbes. I certainly pretty aggressively exposed my younger sister to more microbes, probably several times against her will. But to her benefit, that would have stimulated her immune system, made it less likely that she'd get immune diseases. Now, since this groundbreaking work, exposure to microbes from many different settings has been shown to protect against immune diseases. And asthma has been the most commonly studied disease just because it is the most common, well, probably one of the two most common immune diseases. For example, kids who are exposed to microbes by going to daycare or who are exposed to microbes by growing up on a farm are less likely to get asthma. Conversely, children who receive more antibiotic prescriptions are more likely to get asthma, rather, because the bacteria in their stomach get killed off by the antibiotics. Similarly, kids who are born by cesarean section are more likely to get asthma, again, because they're not as exposed to bacteria at birth. But what about trees and plants? Well, we know that plant leaves are a vast microbial habitat. The leaf area of the world's plants is actually double the world's land area. And there are over 10 to the 26 bacterial cells living on the world's plant leaves. Plant leaves are literally crawling with bacteria. These are three electron micrographs, and they just show the surface of three different leaves. And as you can see, just covered in bacteria. So I teamed up with some scientists in New Zealand to find out if children who are exposed to more diverse plants and hence more diverse bacteria are less likely to get asthma. And so we followed the 50,000 children who were born in New Zealand from 1998 for the rest of their adult lives. And again, I'm just going to cut right to the chase. Now, this figure may look a little daunting. It's called a hazard plot ratio, but it's really all it does is it shows the relationships between the characteristics of a child listed on the left and the likelihood that a child develops asthma. So if the four little horizontal lines associated with a characteristic are to the left of that vertical red line, it means something's associated with a lower risk of asthma. To the right of the red line, higher risk of asthma. So for example, we found that girls are less likely to get asthma than boys, consistent with past research. We also found that if you were born low birth weight, that increased the risk of asthma, which is kind of an interesting tie-in with my previous birth outcome study there. But what about plants? Oh, and also for the data nerds among you, the reason there are four horizontal lines is I use four different definitions of asthma, just to make sure that my results weren't an artifact of the particular definition I chose to use. So what about plants? Well, we measure plants in a couple of ways. First, we use the normalized difference vegetation index, and that's a greenness index derived from satellite imagery. And what we found is that for each one standard deviation increase in greenness that a child was exposed to, the risk that that child developed asthma went down by 6%. Okay, well, that's, you know, it's good. But we also found is if that greenness was more biodiverse, then that child was even less likely to get asthma. Specifically, each additional land cover type that a child was exposed to was associated with an additional 7% decrease in asthma risk. That's on top of the greenness one. So let me give you an example that makes that a little clearer. The data I used, New Zealand is split in forest cover, was split into three broad categories. So let's first assume that that one standard deviation in greenness comes from just one forest type. Well, then that would be associated with a 6% decrease in asthma risk. Now let's assume that that same one standard deviation increase in greenness, just the same amount of green, it's spread across all three forest types. So you're going to get more trees, more understory plants, more bacteria, and that will be associated with a 20% reduced risk of asthma. So quite a difference there. Now I'm really pressed for time here, so I'm not going to go into details about my work on childhood leukemia, but I will say that children who were exposed to more diverse trees and plants had a significantly reduced risk of developing leukemia. And that's the world's most common pediatric cancer, so that's not a trivial result. So what you see here really is just biodiversity is another mechanism linking trees and health in the same way as the mechanisms I talked about earlier, improved air quality and reduced stress, for example. Now, I've crammed a lot into 15 minutes. What I hope I've done above all else is convinced you that urban trees are literally a matter of life and death. If we let them, trees can help us live longer, healthier lives. In particular, and I'm very passionate about this, is that exposing children to trees and plants helps gives them the best possible start in life. Now, if you found this research interesting, or if something that you think could inform your decision-making, I do have one favor to ask. Please let the Forest Service and my research station know, because this is at the moment viewed as a slightly esoteric subject rather than as literally a matter of life and death. I think we're actually holding questions to the end, but I will be happy to answer any at that point. And thank you very much for your time.
Great, thank you very much.
Excellent.
Christian, are you on mute?
No, I am right here. I see that Vivek is on his way. There he is.
I'm here. I'll just roll right in. We'll save questions or any comments to the end.
Yes.
Okay. Sounds good. So I'll jump right in then. Hello, everybody. I don't know how you're doing it. I tuned in earlier in the day for a lot of interesting conversation about carbon and trees and different modeling. So you must be up to your eyeballs in presentations and discussion about topics. I wanted to just share with you a little bit today about work that we've been involved with that segues nicely from what Jeff was just presenting. And I'm calling this inequitable ecologies in part because a lot of what we're seeing on the landscape today is locked in many ways from what we've done over the last 50, 80, 100 years. And that really shows itself more evidently in, or more easily and more abundantly in the urban forest. So I want to just start off though today by just talking about how urban forests, just as Jeff's talking about the relationship to life and death, I want to kind of maybe lighten it just a little bit by talking about it as mediating everyday experiences in the sense of what we experience in the urban forest in a day-to-day experience allows us to either get a lot of sunshine, a little sunshine, very clean air, very dirty air if we don't have trees necessarily mediating that. And in what Jeff was just presenting relationship to exposure to bacteria, and in this case, very beneficial bacteria. And so this is an everyday experience kind of thing that communities have. And what I'd like to do is just talk about one of those experiences that we've been spending a lot of time thinking about. And in cities, this really plays out pretty clearly in that we have been going out around and actually measuring air temperatures in cities around the country. And we've been using a relatively straightforward approach where we're essentially going in with a car or a bicycle. We're mounting a sensor on that car or bicycle, and we're driving in routes all around cities. We've done about 25 cities now, and we're going around collecting these hundreds of thousands of measurements every 1 second across three time periods during a day, the morning, the afternoon, and evening. And trees play such a significant role, as you heard from Kristen earlier on, around the services that they provide, that temperature is one of those essential services. And I'd just like to get your thoughts on the fact that we're seeing this play out in cities around the continent and country in terms of what we're seeing in terms of distribution of temperatures in the morning. This is the city of Portland, where in the morning, afternoon, and evening, we see a distribution of red being the hottest and blue being the coolest. And we're seeing this across a resolution of about 1 to 10 meters square. And so we're getting at very high resolution, everyday experiences of what people are, when they're walking around a place or when they're biking around a place, this is what they feel on their skin. So essentially, we're able to pick up on that ambient temperature reading through this technique. What this has got us thinking about a lot more is the idea that there are particular people living in some of the hottest areas of these cities. And if they're not getting the shade, then they're clearly going to be exposed to extreme heat. And as temperatures go up in the summer, and what we're recording anyway, is these temperatures going up, we're seeing that communities with less formal education, less English proficiency, high racial diversity, and access to AC, they're all really falling into historically disinvested and historically marginalized communities are consistently in some of these hottest areas of the city. Now, this has been a pattern that we're observing, not just here in our fair city of Portland, but we've done this in Eugene now, we've done this in Tacoma, Seattle, Vancouver, British Columbia, et cetera. We've done this Sacramento across the West and many parts of the Midwest and East Coast. And we're finding that these patterns really are pretty durable. They really hold up across a lot of landscapes. So we started scratching our heads as to, you know, is it just the luxury effect in the idea that wealthier communities are able to plant more trees and maintain those trees over time, because that all costs money. And so is it just that luxury effect that's playing out, or is there something else going on? And that's where we started digging into the literature that's out there and seeing that, you know, the distributional inequities that are currently present in terms of trees in cities is very apparent in the literature. And so what cities and communities are doing is basically saying this area hasn't had trees for a long time, so let's start planting trees in those areas and improving the urban forest in those areas. And so I'll come back to this in a little bit, but there's some steps that we might need to consider before immediately jumping into that kind of a conclusion. And I wanna talk a little bit about what that essentially looks like. So we've seen this distribution of heat. We've seen that trees are not quite have distributional inequities. And so we started asking the question of what's going on here? What might be the case? And when you look around neighborhoods across the state, across the region, what we start seeing is that one street that has a lot of trees, like this one on the left, another one might have very few, and there's no median strip. There's not even a large median strip on one side, no median strip on the other side of that street. And so getting trees into some neighborhoods is really hard, at least in the public right of way. And so what we end up noticing is that this, while this may be in one city block, we see just a mile away that there's far less opportunity for trees to grow in other places, or far fewer trees in those areas as well. So what I'd like to propose to you today is that, you know, a lot of this is based on a landscape legacy that we've inherited and that we're really trying to understand, recognize, and reassess in terms of our tree planting strategy in cities. So this landscape legacy really leads us into a series of decisions that were made in the 1930s by the federal government, specifically by the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which divided coming out of the recession of the 1920s. You might think that, you know, we're really trying to lift the country up and get lots of housing starts and lots of investment into real estate. And one way that the federal government decided to do this was to start dividing cities up into four grades. This was the A, B, C, and D grades, as they were called. The A grade being, quote, the best grade, where investments were going to pour in. Those were green areas of these cities. There were B grades, which are still desirable, which were these kind of bluish areas in these cities across the country. The C grades were definitely declining, was the term that was used. And those were the yellow colors on these maps. And the D grades were considered hazardous. And those were the red areas on these maps. And so you have these four grades that are really set up to kind of distribute people. And the places that got the red grades were often the people, as this Minneapolis Hennepin County Registrar's Office would record, were often either immigrants, African-Americans, Latinos, Japanese, and all different communities of color were essentially put into these areas that were marked red, or they were already there and those areas were just marked red. And so those areas really were pretty disinvested over from 1930s all the way up to 1968, where the Fair Housing Act kept any of these kinds of activities from happening. So what does all this have to do with trees? Well, what we are finding is when we looked at 108 cities across the country to get an understanding for why we see the distributional effects of tree equity, is it became pretty obvious that when you see, for example, in this graph, at the national level, we see tree canopy in these A, which is the green, the B, which is the blue, the C, which is the yellow, and the D, which is the red, we see that tree canopy across the country in all 108 cities are essentially very predictable in that the A, quote, best areas have a lot more and the D have a lot less. And this played out regardless of what part of the country we were talking about, whether in the Midwest, West, South, or Northeast. And on top of this, not only was there more trees in the A areas compared to the D areas, we found very clear patterns in terms of the impervious surface. So that is how much concrete or asphalt is on the ground in those locations. And again, this pattern was almost unequivocal when we looked across these cities, and it really got us thinking that these neighborhood grades that were set up back in the 1930s really have an exacting mark on what it is that we see in terms of tree distribution, tree canopy today. Of course, that affects air quality, that affects temperature, it affects all these other implications that then could have, as we were hearing in the earlier presentation, long-term health consequences that really play out over time. We wanted to take it a step further and ask the question in relation to what happens over time. So when we look from 1984, in this case, to 2004, and we use the same index that was brought up in the previous presentation that Jeff had, was this NDVI or greenness, we see that greenness across these four types of neighborhoods, the red, yellow, blue, and green, we see the blue and green here is switched. So please pardon that mistake here on this, but the red and green are switched. And we see that the blue line, which is the A grade, is much higher over time. And in fact, in Portland, it has been increasing proportionately across all of these. Though one of the interesting things that we found is on the right side here, we'll notice that this is essentially land surface temperature, is LST, is what that stands for. And this is, again, that greening index or normalized differential vegetation index. And when you look at both of these, it turns out that even if you're planting a lot of trees in the D grade neighborhood, so those are considered the, you know, hazardous or the historically red line neighborhoods, the temperature is still not going down as quickly as it would in the A or B grade neighborhoods. So even if you're putting trees into these historically disinvested neighborhoods, we're still not seeing the effects on temperature. It gets even more interesting, and the last graph that I'll show you today is when we look at a whole bunch of cities across the country, we see over time, this goes out to 2019, that from 1984 to 2019, we can track which cities have been centering the historically disinvested areas. So we're considering this a way to get at a tree equity ratio. And that essentially says, how well are the C and D areas doing in proportion to the A and B neighborhoods, right? So when you look at that ratio, you can, the closer you get to two, the worse, the more inequitable you're becoming. The closer you get to one, the more equitable your forest is, the more equitable distribution your forest has in these cities. And so in Atlantic City, for example, which would be pretty surprising, it started off relatively even between the A and D grades and therefore maintained that. But with Philadelphia and Los Angeles, very different. And let me hone in here with this cluster of bunch of cities right in the middle of this graph here. And if you look just at this blue line of Portland, what we can see is between 1984 and 2004, the ratio was really increasing considerably. And that suggests that there was very little emphasis happening in terms of centering historically disinvested neighborhoods with tree planting. It was much more going wherever you could put the trees, just put the trees down. We're all about quantity, not quality in this case. Though from 2004 till 2019, we've seen that trend, a bucking of that trend, where you're actually seeing a little bit more emphasis in C and D neighborhoods, where possibly, if you know Portland, well, the east side of Portland, likely east of 82nd Avenue, was getting a lot more tree plantings going in. That's likely what we're seeing in those trends. So I'll just close up here in the last few minutes by suggesting that a recent paper that came out in the journal Science was really highlighting this work that we've been doing for about 5 years now, looking at the relationship between particular patterns of housing privilege and its relationship to ecosystems. And the Science paper was essentially saying that residential segregation ultimately led to an effect on the biological community and diversity of neighborhoods. And that plays out through resource distribution, that affects the landscape heterogeneity, that ultimately affects where we're seeing a lot more of these microbes that Jeff was referring to. And that this plays out in this process of environmental justice and social justice kind of playing out. Although the argument that I think is being made here is that the civil rights movements and a lot of those social justice fair and equitable distribution has been of resources has been going parallel to or maybe even away from the urban conservation movements. And so there's some really interesting discussion that at least the urban forestry world is now involved with around some of these new findings that have come out. Finally, I'll just want to end with this idea of, you know, we see neighborhoods that don't have trees and we're saying, let's plant a bunch of trees there. And this is the park near my house where I walk the dogs regularly. And I've noticed over the past several years, this particular stretch of cedars that are starting to dry out. 2016, I noticed that this was just the tops were dry. And then this was just taken this year where most of the canopy is dried out. And we're seeing this decline happen in cedars. And this is even within a park setting. So part of what we're starting to do is monitor these particular sites to see how much is there a loss in hydraulic conductivity of these trees. We're actually got a series of measurements that we're doing across sites that are warm, that are really warm, like those are those historically disinvested neighborhoods, and those that are really, and control sites, and seeing that big differences between at least these three species. And when you take an infrared camera to this, you can really quickly see that the stem of the tree is incredibly hot. That tree is just absorbing a tremendous amount of heat. And as we're seeing summers really amplify in temperatures, we're really concerned about what the implication of just throwing trees in these really hot areas might be. And we might need to find some different strategies. I'll just close with the things that we're doing right now. We're taking a lot of LIDAR data and creating a bunch of online tools for cities to be able to start thinking about where are the trees, where do we think about not just planting trees haphazardly or opportunistically, but being really systematic about identifying where is there a lack of tree cover, where is the urban heat really high, where's the air pollution really high, and then where are communities that have lower income. And communities of color, where we want to start engaging communities at the local level in tree planting. So I'm out of time here, so I'll go ahead and just close it out and leave my contact information, and hopefully we can spur some conversation in some of these topics. Thank you for your time. Appreciate you hanging in there at this last presentation. I know Kristen has a few things to share now.
Great, well, thank you.
Okay, can you see and hear me? I hope.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Donovan and Dr. Shandis. I wish we had more time to discuss the research that that both of you are doing, because you're making a huge impact on the urban forestry field, and what you are showing us and telling us is extremely important. We invited our presenters here today to emphasize the importance of urban trees to the health and well-being of city dwellers. And as you can tell, I'm a cheerleader for urban trees, but I also want to acknowledge that urban trees grow best when their community and neighborhood wants them. Too often, cities plant trees with the best of intentions, but without asking some important questions ahead of time. For example, does this community want trees, or do they first need better access to other city services? What can we do so that current residents won't feel the need or won't be forced to move if this leafier neighborhood starts to gentrify? And who will bear the cost of the water needed to establish the young trees and make sure that they thrive? In short, for community trees to thrive, whether they're along streets, in backyards, in parks, city personnel must make sure that the local residents will welcome additional trees without resentment. So let me see if I can do this. Okay. As urban forestry as a profession, as you might get a sense of from our speakers, is expanding exponentially and globally. Cities are planning for sustainability and a better quality of life for their residents. The concept of the triple bottom line means that cities are thinking about the social, environmental, and economic impacts of new projects. And urban trees, urban forestry, is a part of all of this. In Oregon, the first 30 years of the urban forestry program is ending. Both staff members are close to retirement. The department will soon have fresh energy in this program. However, it's hard to imagine how the urban forestry program and ODF can keep up with a rapid pace of change and continue to be a leader in urban forestry at its current level of funding. We're already seeing a few cities lose momentum with their urban forestry efforts. They are hiring fewer trained urban foresters, dismantling tree committees, and annually removing more trees than they are planting. Opportunities exist for the urban forestry program to help cities reverse these trends. In the final slides, I will suggest a few areas of growth and potential for the urban forestry program. Along with the successful outreach we already do, the urban forestry program could and should play a major role in increasing tree canopy across the state for all of the reasons we've just discussed here, for health and everything else. In the recent Executive Order 2004, several state agencies, including forestry, are being called upon to show how their work can mitigate climate change. In California, decades-old climate change legislation has resulted in large amounts of funding for statewide urban tree planting and management. If the Oregon Urban Forestry Program were to administer climate investment grants similar to those in California, we could incentivize statewide efforts to increase tree canopy and improve urban forest management in many under-canopied areas. Urban wood utilization could also play an integral part of an increased climate change mitigation focus. Grant funding should also support improving and building soils in cities where possible. Trees store a large percentage of their total carbon in their roots, so it's important to invest not only in the trees themselves, but also in making room for them. Finally, I don't mean to imply by this photo that we should or can plant Douglas fir as street trees everywhere. I just want to bring home the concept that urban trees can do a lot to mitigate the consequences of our changing climate. And as this photo shows, urban trees often also offer wildlife benefits. Next, we really need to increase the usage of the statewide tree plotter inventory platform by cities across the state significantly. The platform has so many potential uses for cities and for the urban forestry program, it would take the rest of my time to list them. Currently, we are working towards developing a cost share program for cities that need help in collecting their data and working with them to create management plans. The urban forestry program sees encouraging community use of this software as an integral part of its effectiveness. Last year, ODF hoped to gain support from the Oregon legislature on a strategic agency initiative that, among other things, would have funded additional foresters to serve in the wildland-urban interface, or WUI. The Urban Forestry Program has a role to play in helping city leaders and staff with making policy and regulatory decisions to maintain healthy forests in fire-prone areas. The program could also play a role in training the next generation of city planners in community fire preparedness planning. Again, as the climate changes around us, even cities in Western Oregon cannot presume to be safe from wildfire. Related to wildfire preparedness is building an urban forestry strike team to serve the state or region, which would complement the recovery programs that Oregon already has. The Urban Forestry Strike Team program was developed by state forestry agencies and the Forest Service in the Southern Region, or Region 8, and it has been adopted in other areas of the U.S. as well, but not yet in the West. These strike teams provide professional recovery services to communities following ice storms, hurricanes, earthquakes, and other natural disasters. The goal of the Urban Forestry Strike Team program is to provide assistance in planning, response, recovery, and mitigation of the urban forest following destructive weather events. Over 3/4 of Oregon's population lives in urban and urbanizing areas, and that number is growing. On the chance that climate change-related funding could come our way, on the chance that a department strategic initiative could be funded by the legislature, and on the chance that we are successful in future grant requests, the Urban Forestry Program could expand to address all of the opportunities I've just described and has been described by our presenters. Some of these roles could complement existing jobs within ODF, and I would hope ODF would take advantage of hiring the growing number of well-trained, enthusiastic urban foresters outside the agency. In the literature of the American West, trees and Oregon are practically synonymous. Across the state, heritage trees are recognized for the stories they tell about Oregon's history. Trees can bring together a community in mourning and in celebration. The Hiroshima peace trees being planted in these photos are symbols of hope for a peaceful future. Urban forests provide benefits we cannot live without. They play an integral part of improving human health. They make underserved areas in cities livable. They play a role in mitigating climate change and offsetting carbon. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Donovan and Dr. Shandis, again for joining us today to help me tell this story. So after today's meeting, we hope that everyone will see the urban forests around them slightly differently, reflect upon the future of urban forestry in Oregon, and when possible, tell the story of Oregon Department of Forestry's Urban and Community Forestry Assistance Program and the important work that we and our presenters do. Thank you. And I guess we have a few minutes for questions.
Board members, are there any questions at this point? I do want to thank you for arranging this. I think it was really well done. The board several years ago, if my memory serves me correctly, spent a day in the Portland area on the urban forestry program, which I thought was really well done. And I know that the board is all, we have the problem of how many you know, field trips are not easy to do, but they're really, I think everybody really enjoys them when we do them. And I think the changes that have occurred, at least in emphasis, I think now, you know, the themes of equity and inclusion and, you know, the health benefits and aspects of urban tree programs are becoming more and more clear and important. And I think it would be a good thing to spend and another one of those days on this general area sometime, maybe in the next couple of years, if I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, within a few months, none of the board members will have been, as board members at least, had that kind of exposure. And I think it would be helpful.
That's true.
I think when you started today, you talked some about funding and the federal funds that have been available. Are they keeping pace at all with what's happened in the last few years with federal dollars?
Well, the program hovers around $250,000 to about $265,000 a year. And essentially what that supports is one full-time manager, me, and my colleague, Katie Lampa, who's the community assistance forester who serves the entire state for three-quarter time.
Yeah.
And our previous manager actually decided to retire from the program because he realized that the program could no longer support three staff. So that's sort of the way it's been for the last few years, but we're hopeful that the things might change.
Yeah, that would be good. That would be great. Well, I appreciate everybody participating in this. I think it's been really helpful and really interesting and compelling, I would say, as well. So,
yeah, I agree, Tom, and I agree, Kristen, and everybody that made these presentations. You guys did a fabulous job. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you again for your time and for your attention.
Yeah.